You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I want to give you a content alert. Today, we're going to be talking about female genital cutting, also known as female genital mutilation. As always, take care of yourselves. My guest today is Farzana Doctor, a writer, activist, and psychotherapist. She's the author of four novels, Stealing Nazreen, 6 Meters of Pavement, which won a 2012 Lambda Literary Award, All Inclusive, a Kobo 2015 and National Post Best Book of the Year, and Seven, which Ms. Magazine says, quote, is fully feminist and ambitiously bold. This is an important book for our changing times. Farzana volunteers with We Speak Out, a group that is working to ban female genital cutting in her Dowdy Bora community. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Farzana.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Tristan.
So let's set the stage for your novel. We're going to talk about Seven, which is her latest book, which came out last week. I want to just read people the basic introduction. When Sharifa accompanies her husband on a marriage-saving trip to India in 2016, she thinks that she's going to research her great-great-grandfather, a wealthy business leader and philanthropist. What captures her imagination is not his rags-to-riches story, but the mystery of his four wives, missing from the family lore. She ends up excavating much more than she had imagined. Sharifa's trip coincides with a time of unrest within her insular and conservative religious community, and there is no escaping its politics. A group of feminists is speaking out against khatna, an age-old ritual they insist is female genital cutting. Sharifa's two favorite cousins are on opposite sides of the debate, and she seeks a middle ground. As the issue heats up, Sharifa discovers an unexpected truth and is forced to take a position. So this was a hard book to read. This is a hard subject to talk about.
It is. It's a subject that makes most of us kind of queasy, even people who are really comfortable talking about sexuality because it has to do with violence.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to acknowledge that I took it in little doses, and I'm just going to try to do that today also.
Okay.
So I want to lay out the landscape of this novel before we get into it. So first I want to take the definition of female genital mutilation. This is from the World Health Organization. Female genital mutilation, or FGM, involves the partial or total removal of external female genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. They then go on to break down these various types of FGM, but we can talk about in a minute. This story takes place within the Bora community, which is primarily in India, but also is a diaspora and exists in many other countries. First, I want to know a little bit about the community.
Yeah, so it's a fairly insular community, and we have a lot of rituals that I think are fairly secretive, and khatna is one of those rituals. So it's a subsect of Shia Islam. This community is known for being entrepreneurial, for being exceedingly polite to the point of like not getting involved too much in politics. We're also known for being a little bit regressive in the sense that in the last 40 years or so, the religious leadership has really clamped down on the community and has become very controlling in lots of different ways. So this is a community that if you speak out, if you critique the religious leader, you risk being socially shunned. And that can be very hard if you are very much integrated in the community. And I give one example of if my father had a hardware store in Mumbai that was frequented by the Bora community, people would have boycotted his store by now, because I'm talking about khatna. Thankfully, he doesn't. He lives in the US and I've grown up in Canada, and he's actually not a religious guy, and we have a lot of freedoms because of that.
But there must be some Bora folks also in Canada. I mean, did you grow up in this community solidly?
No, not in the way that other people, some of my activist comrades have. So my dad renounced the religion when he was a young man. My mom was fairly lukewarm. And then we have a very large extended community, and some of those people are fairly orthodox. So I grew up with a lot of different influences, including all of what I just mentioned.
Okay, that's really interesting. And let's define what khatna is.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with all forms of female genital cutting, there's no standardization because it tends to be conducted by these amateur cutters, although more and more we're seeing the medicalization of the practice. Even so, I would say it's probably not standardized. So khatna is type 1 or type 4 FGM is categorized by the World Health Organization, and it usually involves cutting the clitoral hood. However, as you can imagine, sometimes more damage is done because there is no standardization of this practice, and it's all very, very delicate tissue.
I was going to say, it's not that big of an area.
Especially on a 7-year-old, and that's the age at which this practice tends to happen. And it happens because community members who promote the practice believe that it's good for a young person. They believe that it's going to make a girl Nike, which means sexually pure, you know, all that mythology around reducing promiscuity.
Yeah, so I read in some of the background that there is a passage in a book of jurisprudence which says that it will be chaster, meaning more chaste for their character, and it will make them more beloved by their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
But boys don't have to go through this. Right.
Well, so the people who promote khatna will say, well, boys get circumcised.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very different process. You know, when it's happening for girls, they're often told that they're going to a party or they're going for ice cream. And then so they're tricked, and then they end up in this very kind of scary, painful situation. They might not even know what happened to their own body because no one is, you know, teaching little girls about their bodies. And then they're told afterwards that nothing really happened and to never talk about it. Whereas with boys, you know, generally circumcision, and I don't agree with that either with boys, but with boys it happens generally in medical situations when they're born, and at age 7 there is a ceremony to celebrate it. So it's all out in the open.
That's the interesting thing too, because it's called a ritual, khatna is, but there really isn't ritual here.
That's right.
In the way that we think of religious or spiritual rituals as sort of like set aside time, community members are involved, things are celebrated, maybe there's a card, maybe there's a present. It seems much more secretive and sort of on the fly. And although you're not supposed to talk about it, it is assumed you've had it done.
That's right. Yeah. And some people will say that if you don't have it done, and again, if you're really embedded in the community, this matters, it might be hard for you to get married in the community. And we've heard of, you know, situations where mother-in-laws will ask a prospective, you know, bride-to-be if she's had it done.
And it seems inescapable to think about this as misogynist and as controlling women's bodies, because it sort of explicitly is about affecting their sexuality. In other words, there's lots of other arguments for male circumcision, which may or may not hold up, about hygiene. And also in the Jewish community, it's not about making them more chaste or anything like that. But this seems like it sort of directly says we're doing this to control women's bodies and their sexuality.
100%. This is a form of intergenerational trauma. It's a form of ritual abuse. And it's something that I think there's no other way to think about it. Now, you know, the people who promote this practice will say this is our religious right, and you know, this is something that we just need to do, and it's harmless. And so a lot of the activism that I've been part of has been to talk about the harms that are produced from this. And, you know, the idea is that if we can normalize conversations about this, we can talk about the harms, people can have open conversations, they can talk about their own bodies, they can talk about their own experiences, and hopefully make the right choice for their own kids.
Because it's also, there's a lot about tradition. That's certainly a big central theme in the novel. And this notion that it's been sort of passed on through generations and also unquestioned in some ways. Like the sort of argument, my mother had this done, and my aunts have had this done, and my cousins have had this done. I had this done. So you, my daughter, are having this done. A kind of replication without anyone necessarily stepping in and questioning it.
Yes, and when the holy leader, who is thought of almost like a god, says that it's required, and again, if you have grown up in a community where you're not allowed to question him, you know, you just go forward and you say, this is just what we do.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I want to talk about the novel. The story is really compelling. But let's hear from our sponsors, and we will be back. Pour moi is French, and it means for me. I think that speaks to how we all need to make time for ourselves, take care of our bodies, and prioritize pleasure. Pour moi makes a great new intimate health and stimulation tool called Intensity. You might be tempted to call it a vibrator, but it actually is more than that. Yes, it does vibrate, and we all know what vibration can do for a vulva and a vagina. Intensity by Pour Moi also tones and strengthens your pelvic floor muscles by helping you do your Kegel exercises right. Healthy pelvic floor muscles are really important for vulva owners, no matter what your age is, and they can be the key to stronger orgasms. Win-win. Pour Moi is offering our listeners $25 off of Intensity when you go to pourmoi.com and enter code Tristan at checkout. That's $25 off when you go to pourmoi.com and use promo code TRISTAN. pourmoi.com. The code is Tristan. Pour Moi Intensity. Kegels with a kick. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking with writer, activist, and psychotherapist Farzana Doctor, who's the author of the new book, Seven, which explores a family who is dealing with female genital cutting as a ritual within its own religious conservative community. So I don't want to discount the book here, because actually it's an incredible piece of writing.
Oh, thanks.
In other words, I see that the headline is female genital cutting, like, obviously. But actually, you do something that's sort of clever, which is that you wrap this issue, a painful one. Many people simply don't want to look at within or outside of the community. But you wrap it in a page turner of a book. You wrap it in a really compelling story with fascinating characters, an amazing setting, also pieces of history and sort of constructed flashbacks. It's quite something. So I don't want to discount that also it's effective as a novel, as a story.
Yeah. And all of that was very deliberate. You know, this is my fourth novel and all of my books bring in various social justice issues that I care about. And so I was very, very concerned with how do I tell a really good story? How do I make it page turning? How do I create arcs so that the reader isn't left too long in a dismal place, but, you know, is lifted up by funny stuff and silly stuff and sex scenes and all of that kind of thing. So that was very deliberate. And I really hope that this book ends up being an eye-opener around the issue, but also a pleasure, like, you know, just a good read as well.
Well, yeah, I think it also, another interesting thing that struck me was that Sharifa, the main character, who's kind of struggling to understand her sexuality and her sexual dynamic with her husband, that is really relatable to a lot of people. Now, the reasons that she may be struggling with these issues around sex and around pleasure are specific to this, specific to Kutna and the book. But the ways in which you write about how she feels when she's having sex, how she approaches sex, what she thinks about sex, the dynamic between her and her husband, that feels much more universal. That I've heard that story from a lot of women who may be pre-orgasmic, who may not be able to have an orgasm or have difficulty having orgasms, or just who have some kind of trauma that is impacting their sex lives, but they may not know it.
Yeah, and I think that this is a kind of a universal experience. You know, even thinking about Kutna, I think of it as part of a continuum of gender-based violence, and its impacts are not very different from other forms of trauma, sexual trauma. So what Sharifa is experiencing through the book is very relatable, and anybody who has experienced sexual difficulties or sexual trauma are going to really feel her. And I also wanted to talk about sexual healing in the book. You know, as an activist, I've said we talk about the harms of Kutna a lot, but we don't talk about the nitty-gritties of sexual healing, like what's involved in all of that. And I'm very curious about that because I'm a survivor myself and I'm a psychotherapist. So I wanted to outline a bit of a path through Sharifa and her husband kind of finding their way.
And it's really interesting because I think as the character, so there's these three cousins and they're very close, but one of them, Sharifa, has been living in the United States. They're all kind of reunited and they all represent a different point of view in how they experience, remember, and negotiate having had this done to their bodies. And one thing that struck me is even in attempting to talk about it, there's still a lot of silence and discomfort with talking about sexuality. One of the cousins, I remember, says something like, when they say, well, how has this affected your sex life with your husband? And she says something pretty vague, like, oh, I have no problem in that area.
In that department.
In that department. And I thought, that's not really information at all. You know, as a sex educator, that like led me to more questions, which is, are you having an orgasm? Are you having orgasms regularly? Are you having clitoral orgasms? Are you doing any kind of vulva stimulation? Are you having G-spot orgasms? Are you just not having orgasms, but that doesn't matter? That's not central to your sex life. Like there's no like deep interrogation of it.
Yes.
Just these conversations are so hard to have for these characters who are very close and are also modern, intelligent, educated women.
Yes, and it was important for me to present these varied experiences, both of the remembering and the impacts and their places on the political spectrum around this. You know, one statistic that I've heard recently is something like 35% of survivors would say they don't even know whether it impacted them. And, you know, we all live in sex negative societies. We don't get to learn very much about our own bodies or even what sexuality is for and what pleasure is about, all of that. And so when I heard that over a third of survivors said that they didn't know if it had affected them, it made me just so sad about what's going on in their sex lives. Right. But I needed to have these different characters saying these kinds of things. You know, one character says basically, you know, every time she tries to be sexual, she feels pain. I have another character who doesn't remember anything and just, you know, doesn't even make the link. And then this other character who says she's fine in that department.
Well, and also Sharifa has a little bit of dissociating, I think.
Yes.
Which you describe really well, which is she sort of goes to another place sometimes and isn't necessarily feeling what she does feel or doesn't feel in her body, right? She's like slightly removed from it. And it just points to the ways in which I feel like women are still sort of prohibited from talking about these things. Right? From talking about sexuality and talking about pleasure, even behind closed doors, even, you know, when the three of them are alone and can sort of tell each other anything, there's still this sort of barrier and hesitation.
That's right. And when the main character talks to her mother about it, her mother kind of says, well, you know, is sex really that important in the relationship? So I think we have a lot of denial of, you know, pleasure for women in general. And then in this community, you know, Kutna is this thing that stamps shame on the body at a very young age, along with all the other shame that's just sort of in the air in general.
Well, I was just going to say, right, around women's bodies. Yes.
Yes. So I think we have a lot of reclaiming to do. And so, you know, creating a narrative where Sharifa and her husband can have a bit of a, you know, a BDSM experience together. I was just trying to pave a way for people to think about some of these things a little bit differently.
Well, it was super subversive too that you did the BDSM scene, because I think within conservative religious movements, there is this idea of women submitting to men, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, I think the person who's being considered as the next Supreme Court justice said something about that, how she sort of surrenders and submits to her husband. Super modern attitude. Okay, so not even going to say her name. But so you sort of flip that on its head, which is that when she's given permission to not have to think about it, and she just does, and she just listens, it actually does free something up in her. It actually does give her some space, but that submission is hers to give, and it's consensual.
That's right. And all of the control that she's been holding on to before that is really about seeking safety, but she doesn't know it, right? It's about bracing in her body.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, she has just come out of a kind of emotional affair, which her husband has discovered that she was having on Facebook. Another reason for all of us to get off Facebook. That's a public service announcement. And so she goes on the trip because he gets this teaching job, and she's like, oh, I'm going to do some genealogy, trace the family tree, find out more I can about one of her ancestors who's very well known. His name is on buildings. He founded these various things. And as she does the research and, you know, really digs into it, she finds out that there actually has been resistance to Kutna among her ancestors. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that was very much imagined. That's not something that I have ever come across in any kind of research that I've done. But I wanted to imagine this. I think that women, you know, forever have been resisting in whatever ways that they can. And often it's done very quietly. I actually have a relative who's like a fifth cousin, and she very quietly ended up getting a couple of doctors who were doing Kutna at a local hospital fired, but she did it secretly and quietly. So often this is how things are done. So in the novel, I create this imaginary thread where women in the past have paid off cutters to do what's called a fake cutna, where they don't do a real cut. They pretend to do a cut.
But they sign off on it, basically saying it's been done. Yes,
that's right. So I wanted to imagine just another possibility.
Right, because women have been resisting others controlling their bodies, obviously, for centuries. And those are not the stories that you find in like the archives in textbooks or history books, because it's all done kind of behind the scenes. But it is a moment there that I think is really powerful in the book for her to think of the resistance and just the consideration of this as maybe not great as happened even before they got on the scene, even before these cousins were born. There were ancestors thinking, I don't know if this is a good idea. How are we going to sort of get around this?
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's only been in the last 5 years in our own community that people have been publicly talking about this issue. But I have a feeling that, you know, probably 100 years ago, people were also talking about it very quietly amongst themselves.
So 5 years it feels like the last 5 months, but also like nothing at all. I mean, I think the issue of female genital cutting has been raised. One of the statistics is that from the World Health Organization is more than 200 million girls and women alive today have been cut in 30 different countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, where FGM is concentrated. And so there have been movements in other countries, in other communities about this. Before I read your book, I had no idea that this was a practice among folks in India and the diaspora of Indian people. So why do you think it took so long, even among conversations happening about this in other countries, for the Bora community to sort of address it head on?
Yeah, and I think some of it has to do with just how secretive this practice is, how taboo it is to talk about it, how taboo it is to talk about sexuality and genitals. So there's already all this secrecy around it. And then, you know, women from the African continent have been talking about this for such a long time. They've been talking about type 2 and type 3 primarily, which are more extreme forms. All of the forms are harmful and cause a lot of emotional, physical, sexual trauma. But I think people in our community didn't associate what was going on with their bodies as FGM, because it doesn't look quite like type 2 and type 3. Type 1 involves cutting the clitoral hood and sometimes also cutting the clitoris, the outside part of the clitoris, obviously. Type 2 is called excision, and it's partial or total removal of the labia minora, and more severe forms can also include removing the clitoris, clitoral hood, and labia majora. And then type 3, which is called infibulation, is narrowing and covering the vaginal opening by cutting and fusing the labia minora or majora, and may also include type 2, so including the cutting of the clitoris and the hood. And then there's this type 4, which is kind of this other category of harmful or non-medical procedures, which can involve like burning, cutting, but in a more kind of scraping or pricking kind of way that just causes other kind of damage. And I wanted to mention as well that activists these days are saying that FGM, FGC happens on every continent except for Antarctica, and we have been hearing about cases of white Christian American women who are also coming forward. So I think that the more we talk about this, the more we normalize these conversations, and the more we put FGM on that continuum of gender-based violence, I think the more we're going to hear about all kinds of different practices happening around the world. Like more recently, we heard about cases in South America and Colombia, and we've heard about cases in Russia. So it's growing as this movement continues to happen. And I think this is, you know, this is our Me Too movement, you know, that's happening for FGM. I think we're going to start to understand just how prevalent all of this is, unfortunately.
Let's take another break. When we come back, more with Farzana Doctor. Life is about balance. And sometimes I want to take my mind off of current events and get my brain thinking about something else, anything else. When I play games on my phone, trivia games are my go-to. Trivia Star is a free mobile quiz game that's as entertaining as it is challenging. For each round, you can choose from over 60 categories like music, sports, movies, TV, animals, celebrities. If you choose the correct answer, and it's just from multiple choice, and beat the clock, you move on to the next level. The questions do get harder over time, but if you get stuck, don't worry. You can use coins and gems to get a hint and beat that level. Right now, Trivia Star is offering 2,500 coins and 500 gems when you download and play. Just go to the Apple or the Google Store and search for Trivia Star. Again, search Trivia Star and enjoy 2,500 coins and 500 gems. Download Trivia Star for free today. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Farzana Doctor is a writer, activist, and psychotherapist. Her new book is a novel called Seven, which we've been talking about today. You know, I was interested, Farzana, that you said that, you know, that FGM happens on all continents except Antarctica. And it does happen in the United States. In the US, there is a federal law which makes female genital mutilation illegal, but it has been tested in court, and a federal judge in Detroit in 2019 ruled that it wasn't constitutional. So technically, people are doing it and not being penalized for it.
That's right. You're talking about the US versus Nagarwala case. And I like to say her name. Let's not ever forget her name. She is the doctor, the US licensed doctor who was charged with performing FGM on 9 girls. And you're right, most of those charges were dismissed because the federal law, which bans FGM, was deemed unconstitutional for regulating a state level offense. It was a legal loophole. So it's good that authorities are prosecuting, but I think it's a very limited way of addressing the issue. I think where we're going to do much more is by, again, talking about it. We need to be talking about this issue in a way that doesn't make us queasy anymore. We need to, you know, I mentioned before we started talking that I'm almost desensitized, but that took many, many years. But I think if we can keep this conversation alive, we're going to be able to really get to the people who need to hear about this and stop this practice. You know, I don't know that the law is going to do very much for anybody.
Yeah, the law is behind in so many ways. And also, I would think that if people are being found out and charged, that's just going to drive it further underground. And it seems really deeply underground right now. So the idea that it would go even deeper among more secrecy would also make it less safe. I mean, talking about the people who are having it done right now, this is dangerous. This is also a medical procedure sometimes not being performed by doctors.
That's right. It can, you know, in worst case scenario, girls die in these kinds of situations. So it's really intense. And I would really love it if more people got involved. You know, there's this thing that happens, I think, sometimes in these conversations where people don't become allies because they think, oh, it's, you know, those people over there, it's their culture, it's their religion. But all over the world, there are feminists who are, you know, speaking out about this. So I think if we look at it for what it is, violence against girls, women, and non-binary folks trying to control their sexuality, I think more allies could get involved in all of this and join the groups that are, you know, the survivor-led groups that are fighting this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're centering the survivors and if you're centering the folks in the community and you're taking your lead from them, then it seems like a no-brainer to be an ally. And this also brings me to my next question, which is, one of my favorite characters in this book is Sharifa's husband. Mm-hmm. In the movie, I imagine him being played by Seamus Caan. That's probably like doesn't mean that much to people, but Seamus Caan was on my show many weeks ago talking about he's a sociologist and he's a professor. And I don't know why, but I just picture Seamus Caan when I picture Sharifa's husband. He's just sort of like really present and really caring and really thoughtful. But I'm wondering, like, what role do men play in this movement?
Yes, they have to play a role. You know, the way that it happens, at least in our community, until recently when this became a more public issue, men didn't know anything about it. Mm. Like when I first spoke to my father about it, he was like, no, this doesn't happen in our community. So men are kept very much in the dark around this issue. So, you know, and men have more power in our community. So if men start saying like, stop this, this is terrible, this is, you know, archaic, stop it, I think that that's going to help. And then, you know, for people who are in heterosexual couples, men can play a really great role in, you know, being allies in the healing process, you know, in general for any kind of trauma, but also with Kutna trauma, because I think that often the healing does happen in an experiential way. You know, it happens through being sexual, feeling our bodies, being mindful, pausing when we need to pause, feeling like we are in control of our bodies again, all of that. So I think that male partners have a big role to play.
And that's what's so great about this character is he's the kind of guy who like immediately does research.
And even he's an academic.
Like, he's an academic. So he's like, oh my God, I've got to know everything about this. And even Sharifa at that point is like, can I just let this like settle in for a minute? But he ends up kind of telling the audience some options around healing and around healing in partnership. And so he gets to convey all that information and also, you know, play the role of the partner you kind of want in all trauma experiences, which is like patient and loving and also angry and will hold a sign up when called to, you know, because they go to this protest. He's such a great character. Like everyone wants that husband.
I want everyone to be Murtaza. And I've had some, you know, the book came out about a month ago in Canada, and I've had some heterosexual women say, oh my God, he's too good to be true. It bumped a little bit for me that he was so good. And oh. I'm just like, why would that bump? Like he's a great character.
Yeah. I mean, it's because, you know, 50 Shades of Grey and the bar is low for heterosexual guys. Sorry to generalize.
It's too low.
And so but I don't want him to be an exceptional character. I don't want him to be exceptional. I want him to model this behavior so that others can follow in his path. I don't want him to read as not realistic.
Yeah.
That's my own investment in these characters.
You know, fiction has this power, right? It has this power to educate, but it also has this power to lay out possibilities for us. And so I didn't want to write him as a meh character who doesn't do very well. I wanted him to be a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we need that. And as you said, you wanted to balance, you know, the horror of finding out about this and all the ambivalence and how it fractures this particular family. There's a lot of pain. There's just a lot of pain that surrounds this. But also, like you said, then we must move into healing when folks are ready, when survivors are ready. And we also need a path for healing, right? Which we don't necessarily have. And if the silence about all this continues, just the idea about talking about sexuality within marriage, outside of marriage, whatever, if the silence persists, then there's sort of no space for healing.
That's right. Yeah. And so, you know, we need to be able to speak to partners, and because, you know, partners really bear a burden if they have a partner who is experiencing trauma. You know, like we are emotionally regulating one another, our intimate people, all the time, right? And so partners are also suffering, and they're often looking for ways to help and have no idea how to be involved. And you know, there are some good books out there that they can read as well, but this is just one fictional depiction of how it can happen.
I mean, I think this kind of novel, I said this to you at the beginning off the air, which is that, you know, I rarely have novelists on my show, just because, you know, there's so many great thinkers and speakers, and there's so much real life to dig into around gender and sexuality and justice. So I don't often have novelists, but there are certain novels that sort of break through all my walls, and I'm like, okay, I've got to talk to this person.
I'm so glad.
But that's what I love about this book, is that it really does the job of addressing social justice within a really beautifully wrought story. And without being sort of like preachy and, oh my God, now they're on the soapbox, now we've lost the plot, and it's all about just sort of like the narrator and or the author lecturing us. You know, in some ways this feels, you know, more like a Trojan horse, which is like, hey, read this novel, and then, oh shit, you're going to learn a lot about a lot of things here. So I just appreciate that strategy, that you clearly use fiction in these ways that are political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know that my main character is someone who is a little bit clueless about so many things. And I wanted her to be that way so that she could be unraveling the mysteries along with the audience being able to follow her. Mm-hmm. and get the information bit by bit so that it wouldn't be overwhelming or shocking.
And there's really a strength to these women's relationships. And also they're very complicated, right? Because in this case, Sharifa's mom explicitly said, I don't want this done. And her sister, one of the aunties, had it done anyway while Sharifa was out of, you know, was in India and away from her mom. So there's also these like really intense family dynamics that have to be sort of gone through, which again, I don't know, for me, it pointed to the fact that this wasn't simply dismissible as like, oh, that was the old generation and now we're the new generation and we're doing things differently. It was way more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, with this practice, there often is this kind of betrayal of a family member doing things, because you know this is a collectivist culture, and so one parent might have one view, but you know the collective might think that they have a better answer.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for spending this time with me. Thanks for writing this book. I highly recommend it, folks. Buy it for all your friends. The book is Seven. It's from Dundurn Press. You can get it where you buy books. I especially encourage you to support local and independent bookstores. You can order it through bookshop.org, for example. You can find out more about Farzana at farzanadoctor.com, FarzanaDoctor.com. Also, you can find out about the organization she works with, which is working to end female genital cutting. It's WeSpeakOut.org. Lots of great information there. Farzana is at Farzana Doctor across all social media platforms. Just really appreciate you and the work that you do in the world.
Oh, thank you so much. And likewise, I've been such a big fan of yours for a long time.
Thanks. I want to thank my engineer and editor, A-Rod, at FTC Designs. You can follow him on Twitter at FTC_designs. You can follow me across all social media platforms at Tristan Taramino. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. And I want to let you know that in just a few weeks, we are going to do an episode on male or penis circumcision. So I think we need to hear about all forms of genital cutting. And so that's going to come up. Just be on the lookout for that. Next week, my guest is Jen Mannion, who is a historian and has written a fabulous book called Female Husbands, A Trans History. Don't want to miss that. And so please, in the meantime, before I see you again, before you hear my voice again, take some time to talk about sex out loud.